Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Unless you have young children, you may not know that it's a standard practice in schools all across the country to practice lockdown drills in preparation for a mass shooting emergency. I can only wonder how this type of preparation spawns fear in our children, leaving them feeling unsafe even at school. Some schools are participating in a national campaign called Stop the Bleed. This is a government-sponsored program created in part by the American College of Surgeons. Volunteers are trained in how to act as first responders by learning how to prevent victims from bleeding to death. Kits with tourniquets and bandages with quick clotting material are now found in homes, community centers, and schools. We're going to read a New Yorker article today titled Under the Gun, which describes why the Stop the Bleed program came into being and how aid is given. This was written by Paige Williams for the April 8th, 2019 issue, and I should let you know that if you have a very queasy stomach, you may not want to listen to this today. One April morning in 2014, a 16-year-old sophomore at Franklin Regional Senior High in Murrysville, Pennsylvania, stole two butcher knives from his parents' kitchen, hid them in his backpack, and took them to school. He was wearing all black and, according to witnesses, had a blank expression. Just before first period in the hall of the science wing, he stabbed several classmates. Then he pulled the fire alarm. As the corridor filled with people, the boy moved down the hallway, a knife in each hand, stabbing more students. He turned and raced back up the hall. An administrator remembered him flailing the knives like he was swimming the backstroke. One girl later testified, "I could feel that my lip wasn't attached to my face anymore." A boy stabbed in the belly recalled, "I was gushing blood." The students at Franklin Regional, which is 17 miles east of Pittsburgh, had been trained to lock themselves inside classrooms during a Code Red event. In one room, a home economics teacher called 911 as she attended to an injured boy. A dispatcher asked where the patient had been hurt. "The lower abdomen," the teacher said, "on the right side." "Do you have any way to control the bleeding?" the dispatcher asked. "I'm putting pressure on it," the teacher said. She was stanching the blood with paper towels. This was helpful, the dispatcher told her, saying, "If it starts soaking through, I don't want you to lift it up at all. Find anything else you can to put on top of that." The teacher had been applying pressure for about 4 minutes when the dispatcher said, "We have the actor in custody," adding, "But I don't want you to let any of your students leave that room." As the teacher bore down on the wound, she talked with the injured boy, her voice tense but cheerful. They joked that he could use the experience in a college application essay. When he predicted that his mother was going to have a panic attack, the teacher said, "I think she will." Then she said, "I never thought I'd have to do this." Gracie Evans, a 17-year-old junior at the time, remembers that she was walking down the hall with her friend Brett when someone rushed past them like a black mass. She didn't realize that Brett was hurt until he fell to the ground withering in pain. He had been stabbed in the back. In front of her, a boy in a red hoodie grabbed his stomach. A third boy collapsed. The victims took refuge in a nearby science classroom. Brett's wound did not look life-threatening, so Gracie dropped to her knees beside the boy in the red hoodie. She raised the hem of his sweatshirt and saw blood pouring out of a clean slit above his waistband. Although she had never witnessed real physical trauma before, she didn't flinch. Her mother was an orthopedic nurse, and she'd seen videos of athletes' legs broken at grotesque angles. Gracie recalls that someone handed her a big wad of those terrible brown paper towels that aren't very absorbent. She placed them over the gash, interlaced her fingers, and pushed. a dancer. She'd been told that she was stronger than she appeared, and she worried that she might be hurting her classmate. But she kept pressing. The boy suddenly vomited, and part of his liver emerged from the wound. Gracie, nauseated, let go, and blood rushed out again. "I'm so sorry," she cried, unable to continue. Another student who happened to be an EMT took over, buying the boy more time. 21 people had been knifed, several severely, yet everyone survived. The attacker was later sentenced to a minimum of 23 and a half years in prison. Law enforcement and healthcare professionals in the Pittsburgh area took note of the fortitude and the competence of many bystanders. Listening to a playback of the teacher's 911 call, they marveled at her calm and her effectiveness. Brad Orsini, an FBI agent who worked the case, told me, "You'd have thought it was just another day for this woman." At one point, the teacher had told the boy, "You know what? Sometimes when stuff happens, you go into a different state of mind. You surprise yourself at how you can handle things." A category of emergency known as an intentional mass casualty event is now considered a public health crisis. In recent years, deadly attacks have occurred at schools, offices, concerts, sporting events, shopping malls, and houses of worship. They have involved guns, knives, trucks, and improvised explosive devices. In March, a gunman killed 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Much attention has been given to the rising frequency of mass shootings in the United States, but equally alarming is their worsening severity. In the attack at Columbine High School, which occurred in 1999, 13 people were killed and 24 were injured. In the 2017 massacre at a music festival in Las Vegas, 58 people were killed and 851 were injured. The arsenal of the Las Vegas perpetrator included the AR-15 assault rifle, a weapon that has been used in many rampages. In fact, he had 14 of them with him. Bullets shot from an AR-15 travel at an extremely high velocity. The force of the ammunition can shatter the bones in a human arm merely by grazing it. Last year, Richard Carmona, a former U.S. Surgeon General, said, "More and more, the injuries we're seeing in the civilian world look like combat casualties." After the 2018 shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, 17 killed, 17 injured, a trauma surgeon opened up a victim to find at least one organ in shreds with nothing left to repair. For victims whose injuries are serious but survivable, rapid treatment is essential. A person can bleed to death in as little as 5 to 8 minutes. Traditionally, during an active shooter event, paramedics held back until law enforcement secured the area, then rushed in to treat the wounded and evacuate them to hospitals. That approach changed after Columbine. During that event, rescuers, unable to determine if the killers were dead or hiding, didn't reach some victims for hours. In a second-floor science lab, teachers and students were stranded with a coach, Dave Sanders, who'd been shot once in the neck and once in the back. Two Eagle Scouts applied pressure to his wounds, and someone else put a sign in a window, "One bleeding to death." Sanders died at the scene. It's unclear whether he would have survived with quicker or different treatment. The Las Vegas shooter positioned himself in a sniper's nest, a hotel window overlooking the festival, and sprayed the crowd with bullets. In this case, it was impossible to stage an orderly transition from a security phase to a medical phase. Victims arrived at hospitals in Ubers and pickup trucks, or in the arms of loved ones and strangers. As public shootings become commonplace, doctors started paying more attention to them. One such doctor was Lenworth Jacobs, the head trauma surgeon at Hartford Hospital in Connecticut. He'd grown up in Jamaica, where his father was a doctor. When Jacobs was about 7, he and his dad came across an injured bicyclist by the side of the road, and the sight of his father urgently helping a stranger left a lasting impression. Jacobs told me that trauma surgery appealed to him because each case contains a beginning, middle, and end. A patient presents with a problem, a gunshot wound, a stabbing, which is then resolved one way or another. When Jacobs wasn't operating, he devised protocols that would help increase survival rates in the emergency department. At Hartford, he founded LifeStar, the first helicopter ambulance service in Connecticut. On December 14, 2012, a deranged young man with a semi-automatic rifle and two handguns entered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, an hour away from Hartford Hospital. The hospital is a Level 1 trauma center, a designation that signifies the highest level of care. As news of the shooter reached Jacobs, he prepared to send medevac choppers to Newtown, but was soon advised to stand down. "You hear, everybody's dead, and that makes no sense," he told me. "Then you hear, it's children, and that makes no sense." 20 first graders had been killed, along with 6 administrators and teachers. Jacobs wondered whether the shocking number of casualties was related to the local emergency response or to the nature of the gunshot injuries, or both. He reviewed the autopsy reports, and although he had successfully operated on patients with unimaginable physical trauma, he was nevertheless unprepared for what he saw. Many of the children had been shot multiple times at close range. The reports, he said, were overwhelming. The victims at Sandy Hook likely died instantly, but Jacobs, unable to go back to business as usual, kept thinking about what could be done to reduce casualties in the future. There was not even a second to waste in such incidents. The wounded had to be treated immediately at the scene. Jacobs was a regent of the American College of Surgeons, an organization with some 80,000 members worldwide. At an ACS meeting soon after Sandy Hook, he urged his colleagues to focus on mitigating losses in intentional mass casualty events. "Obviously, prevention is the way to go," he said. "But once something has happened, how can we increase survival?" In trauma care, the primary cause of preventable death is hemorrhage. External bleeding can always be controlled in an extremity wound if it is addressed quickly enough. No one should bleed to death from an arm or a leg injury, even with the loss of a limb. This message had never been clearly conveyed to the public. 4 months after Sandy Hook, Jacobs convened a small group of physicians, military leaders, and law enforcement officials, including representatives of the FBI and the Department of Defense, at Hartford Hospital. The group became known as the Hartford Consensus. One member was Frank Butler, an ophthalmologist and a former Navy SEAL platoon commander. In the 1990s, Butler reviewed the state of battlefield trauma care in the U.S. military. He ultimately discovered that during the Vietnam War, more than 3,400 service members died because of hemorrhaging from extremity wounds. For Butler, a solution came to mind: tourniquets. The devices are known to have been used as far back as 1674 during the Franco-Dutch War. Early versions consisted of a strip of cloth and a stick, which was used as a windlass. Modern tourniquets work much the same way. You snugly encircle a bleeding limb with a band of cloth, then turn the windlass, tightening the band until it stops the flow of blood. Tourniquets lost favor after the Civil War because of their association with gangrene and amputation. By the time of Butler's review, medical doctrine had long held that tourniquets did more harm than good. It was true that the longer a tourniquet stayed in place, the more it could damage the surrounding tissues and nerves. But in the modern era, a patient could usually be evacuated quickly to a hospital. Moreover, early tourniquets hadn't always been used properly. They were strapped below the wound instead of above it, or they weren't tight enough. In a report, Butler argued that the no-tourniquet rule, a venerated tenet of pre-hospital trauma care, was wrong. As he recently put it to me, tourniquets save lives, period. Butler's recommendations also introduced the concept of tactical combat casualty care. Soldiers trained with basic life-saving skills and equipment could act as frontline medics when necessary. Several elite combat units immediately embraced the idea. The Army's 75th Ranger Regiment, whose members had seen comrades bleed to death from extremity wounds during the 1993 battle in Mogadishu, began training with tourniquets during simulated missions. Soldiers were taught how to apply a tourniquet to themselves or to someone else within seconds. A group of soldiers at Fort Bragg in North Carolina designed a tourniquet that was optimized for battlefield conditions. The device, which came to include a built-in windlass secured by a plastic clip and a Velcro strap, is called a Combat Application Tourniquet, or CAT. An outdated technique had become a modern cure. Tourniquets are now standard issue in the U.S. military, along with hemostatic dressings, sterile gauze infused with kaolin, a clay that promotes swift blood clotting. By 2012, the Journal of Vascular Surgery reported some soldiers were embarking on missions with tourniquets already in place on their limbs. In April 2013, when Jacobs and the other experts convened at Hartford Hospital to talk about intentional mass casualty events, they discussed the tourniquet revival. The group decided that the military's standardized approach to controlling external hemorrhage could be applied to civilian life. Members of the public could be trained to identify and treat life-threatening bleeding. The Hartford Consensus devised a protocol, Stop the Bleed, in the hope that it would become as widely known as CPR and Stop, Drop, and Roll. Jacobs told me that Stop the Bleed training had to be short enough to fit between church and cooking dinner, or between dinner and the football game, and simple enough for a sixth grader to understand. The instruction had to focus on one goal: keep the blood in the body. He and his colleagues knew that the protocol would save lives if they could persuade people to use it. 13 days after the Hartford Consensus first met, explosive devices filled with nails and ball bearings detonated near the crowded finish line of the Boston Marathon. The sidewalks of Boylston Street were strewn with injured spectators. As a team of specialists later wrote in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, the bombing was the first major terrorist attack in the modern United States, with multiple severe warlike lower extremity injuries. More than a dozen people lost limbs in the blasts. Boston has many hospitals, and paramedics were quick to the scene, but they were astonished by how many spectators had already applied pressure to wounds using clothing or coffee shop napkins. Much of the early life-saving was performed by amateurs, the Washington Post reported. Although more than 200 people were injured, only 3 died, and the New England Journal of Medicine credited this achievement in large part to courageous civilians. The marathon attack confirmed the Hartford Consensus's view. People would instantly help one another during a crisis, even when the injuries were almost unbearable to see, much less to touch. The real first responders were bystanders. One icy morning in mid-January, Matthew Neal, a trauma surgeon and a research scientist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, got in his car and drove 26 miles north of the city. He arrived at Mars Area High School, where more than 200 employees of the public school district were filing into the auditorium for a mandatory Stop the Bleed seminar. They wore puffy coats and snow boots and carried Starbucks cups and thermoses that were still warm. Neil, who is 38, is tall and lean with a resonant voice. People call him Mackie. He has his own laboratory, which recently received a grant partly funded by the Department of Defense to study treatments for types of bleeding that don't respond to compression, such as certain belly wounds. One night, when I joined his family for dinner, he told me, "My whole focus is blood." He stood at the front of the auditorium with Raquel Forsyth, another UPMC trauma surgeon, who wore a voluminous red scarf and had her hair in a high bun. They used a laptop to project a presentation onto a screen. One slide read, why do I need this training? The answers included mass shootings, motor vehicle crashes, home injuries, and bombings. The stabbings at Franklin Regional Senior High had occurred in the wake of other horrific attacks in the Pittsburgh area, including shootings at an LA fitness franchise and a psychiatric clinic. The city's trauma specialists reviewed these tragedies, but Neil told me they often ended a case analysis feeling a bit empty. No matter how nimble first responders are, Neil is prone to say, I can't do anything if the patient's dead. In October 2015, the American College of Surgeons launched a national Stop the Bleed campaign. The White House backed it. President Barack Obama declared that national disaster preparedness was a shared responsibility between citizens and the government. And Vice President Joe Biden described Stop the Bleed as a call to action for anyone in a position to help. Cities at high risk for gun violence, including St. Louis and Baltimore, welcomed the program. Lori Punch, a trauma surgeon and a leader of St. Louis's Stop the Bleed efforts, has said that trainers want people to discover that they're not just victims, that they can actually save a life. The Orlando Fire Department was modernizing its first responder protocol when, in June 2016, a gunman shot up the Pulse nightclub, killing 49 people and injuring 53. Trauma specialists based at George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C., found that four of the victims might have survived if they'd received basic EMS care within 10 minutes and had been transported to a trauma hospital within an hour. None of those who died had received tourniquets or other bleeding control interventions. 2 days after the Pulse shooting, the American Medical Association voted to adopt a new policy aimed at training the general public in bleeding control. In Pittsburgh, Andrew Peitzman, UPMC's chief of surgery, urged the hospital system to embrace Stop the Bleed. Seminars were soon held throughout the region with a special emphasis on training law enforcement officers. UPMC announced that it would donate more than $1 million to provide such supplies as tourniquets and hemostatic gauze to every public school, and to put a tourniquet on the belt of every law enforcement officer in western Pennsylvania. By the start of this year, nearly 40,000 people in western Pennsylvania had been trained, and bleeding control kits had been handed out to some 500 public schools in the area, more than anywhere else in the country. Stop the Bleed uses a ripple approach. Volunteers train people who in turn train others. At the Mars Area High School seminar, Neil and Forsyth were the volunteers, along with a group of Cranberry Township paramedics and UPMC flight nurses. The team also included a more unusual participant, Neil's 9-year-old son, Cameron, who often helps his father teach workshops. He was standing with the other volunteers in a red and blue striped shirt, khaki cargo pants, and glasses. Before Christmas, Cameron's third grade teacher had assigned how-to presentations. Recommended topics included how to bake cookies or make a paper airplane. Although Cameron has various areas of expertise, Legos, Kung Fu, he chose to demonstrate Stop the Bleed. The standard presentation contains graphic images, an enormous leg gash, a nearly severed foot. Mackie Neal warns audiences that the photographs may be upsetting, and trainees sometimes look away or leave. The queasiness is understandable. Blood is supposed to remain inside the body, and it can be sickening to see it released, especially in large quantities. Blood is slippery and messy, and it has a strong metallic smell. Under certain circumstances, it may transmit disease. In traumatic injuries, blood may be mixed with bone tissue, body tissue, and teeth and bone. Neil, the son of a Pennsylvania state police commander, believes that showing people images of severe injuries, if done sensitively, can reduce their unease in a crisis later, just as the use of dummies in CPR training helps people overcome the discomfort of performing chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation during a cardiac arrest. Primarily, the images are intended to help attendees identify life-threatening bleeding. Many bystanders' instinct is to cover up blood, but as Forsyth put it, to stop bleeding, you need to see bleeding. Paramedics talk about getting patients trauma naked, moving aside any clothing and pinpointing the source of hemorrhage. The loss of a limb is automatically considered life-threatening. In other cases, there are warning signs. Is blood pooling around the victim? Is the blood spurting? Are bandages saturated? Bystanders should pay close attention to a victim who becomes suddenly irrational or loses consciousness, symptoms that suggest the onset of hemorrhagic shock. Explaining that people can bleed to death in as little as 5 to 8 minutes, Forsyth told the audience, it often takes EMS that long to respond. The location of a wound dictates treatment. For an arm or a leg, use a tourniquet. For a junctional injury, neck, armpit, groin, press against the wound or pack it with gauze. Place the victim on a hard surface to maximize pressure. For a chest, belly, or head wound, the most helpful interventions, such as suction or a needle thoracostomy, require EMS training. But applying pressure can help a patient hold on. And that is where I'm going to stop this today with that little bit of information about how to deal with different types of injury. And I wanted to let you know the organization that is associated with the American College of Surgeons is bleedingcontrol.org. And on that website, you can find educational materials, booklets, and posters. And you can also find kits there that have the CAT-type tourniquet and the quick clot dressings, compression bandages, and the kits also include an instruction booklet. So that can be found at bleedingcontrol.org. We will finish this article next week. I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Please stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.